All right, so please let's welcome Dinesha Carley, and she's going to be talking about researching, designing, and building urban pollinator-friendly gardens, which is a great follow-up to HRI.
That's right. Thank you. Of course, I think she just stepped out, but, you know, y'all waited, left the best for last here, so thank you. I know, I hate that I'm standing between y'all and cocktails, but I promise if I don't make you laugh, I should at least make you smile. I'd also like to acknowledge my co-authors, Marisol and Anne, are also both here. And this is obviously a collaborative effort. I just drew the short straw and had to present. I'm kidding. I wanted to. I love this stuff. So pollinators are one of my great passions, and I do come from a plant background, although I'm fairly new in horticulture. So I'm still learning horticulture, but I know pollinators pretty well. And since I had an audience, I thought I would take the opportunity to educate y'all about pollinators just a little bit, right? Because I wouldn't be a good extension person if I didn't do that. So I usually ask my students when I show them this slide, you know, well, which of these are pollinators? And it isn't a trick question, right? They usually, like, sort of keep really quiet, and then somebody will finally be like, well, all of them are. And it's so true. Every one of the animals up here is a pollinator. But the most efficient pollinators, and I'm still working on how this works, are bees, and it's primarily because they are furry, right? They're hairy. So we have our the darling of agriculture, our Apis mellifera, our honeybee up here, and then I have a bumblebee down there in the corner, and bees, as I said, are most efficient. So usually when we talk about pollinator habitat, we are talking about habitat that we are trying to encourage for the health of our bees. Now, a lot of people... Sorry, I just saw a fly by, and he was right up there already on my screen. So now I had three flies. So a lot of people also like butterflies, and we hear a lot about monarchs, and so we talk a lot about butterfly gardening. But these other pollinators are important, and in fact, the second largest order of pollinators are flies. However, nobody has a bumper sticker that says, save the flies, right? And so, again, we mostly talk about bees, but I want everyone to remember that flies are very, very important, especially in colder climates, especially in areas like Colorado, where the temperatures can get very, very cold, and bees are not very efficient under cold temperatures, so they're not pollinating crops. And so those alpine meadows really need flies. And if you are a lover of chocolate, as I am, then you can appreciate flies as well, because it is a fly that pollinates cacao. So while I like the flies in my cacao crops, I do not like them in my chocolate. Okay, so pollinators are very important. Y'all already probably know this. Bees specifically pollinate over 75% of all agricultural crops. So they're very important in terms of food production. Again, I am a big fan of food. So, again, I love pollinators for many, many reasons, but I also really like to eat. And so anyone who wants to eat should really have an appreciation of pollinators as well. The reason we're talking about pollinators, aside from the fact that I like to eat, is that there has been a decline worldwide in pollinators over the last number of decades. And it isn't just honeybees, although we hear mostly about honeybees. And when we talk about pollinator decline or pollinators, almost everyone can say, oh, yeah, honeybees are in decline. And one of the earlier speakers even mentioned, you know, that sad little bumblebee with the deformed wing virus. And I'm sorry, honeybees. And, of course, honeybees are in decline, and they do have a lot of issues. However, native bees are also in decline, although we know a lot less about native bees because we're not studying them as much. And because they're not managed as honeybees and bumblebees are, we don't have the same decline numbers in general, but we're still concerned about their decline as well. And this is, of course, a concern for anyone who's interested in agriculture, anyone who's interested in landscape plants, but also anyone who's just interested in the environment in general. There are a lot of factors that contribute to the decline in pollinators worldwide, and again, some of them were mentioned earlier. Diseases and pests, of course, are a big one. Climate change is also impacting pollinator health a great deal. There are, of course, issues with chemistry and the way we misapply it or treat seeds with neonicotinoids or other crops. But the one that I primarily work in, both research and outreach, is the loss of feeding and nesting habitats, and that is primarily due to urbanization. And so, yes, when we talk about pollinator decline, pesticide exposure and misuse of pesticides is very, very important, as are diseases and pests that we talk about with honeybees or bumblebees. But it's really sort of a puzzle, and so it's all of these things together that are impacting pollinator health. And, you know, as one individual, sometimes if you think about it, you start to get overwhelmed by, well, how can I positively make an impact? But I decided that I would have to just try to make an impact in one area, and so that's where our research and our outreach efforts lie, are again in this trying to encourage folks to add habitat, because it really does make a difference. And so I'm ahead of myself a little bit, but we've done a number of studies that demonstrate that, indeed, if you have pollinator habitat in your home garden or a schoolyard, or as you can see here, this was actually a median strip along a roadside in my neighborhood that had been previously kudzu, and they tore it up because they were doing a stream restoration project, and the neighbors begged them not to, of course, put in more kudzu. Nobody would do that, but but, you know, instead of putting in grass, to put in pollinator habitat. And so it's a strip, it's about 5 feet long and maybe 15 feet wide. I'm sorry, the opposite, 5 feet wide, 15 feet long. And so these little areas might not seem to have a great impact, but they really have been shown to have a dramatic impact, at least on the population diversity in an area, as well as the health, because if you have healthier pollinators, and in this case we're talking primarily about bees because that's where we've done the most research, you also have stronger genetics as well, and so it sort of all feeds into a healthier population overall. I have a little star there, pollinators do fine in the city if there's quality connected habitat, and the reason I put that little star there is that we've done a lot of research at NC State, not with my program, but with other entomologists that work in pollinators, and they've demonstrated that yes, bees do fine in a city, and in fact, they tend to have more diverse populations than in the surrounding native areas, and that's because of y'all. Anytime we plant a diversity of plants, we have a diversity of pollinators, and that is awesome. The issue is that if we have serious heat island effects, that will have a dramatic impact on the population. So we sort of have to think about, you know, the overall impact of urbanization in the city, but if we can only feel like we can tackle one piece, just plant some flowers, and you're going to do a good job helping pollinators. So in the abstract of the talk, we sort of talked about how gardens, and y'all are probably even more aware of this than I am because I tend to think very small pieces, but gardens no longer are sort of just for aesthetics, right? They need to be like the Swiss Army knife of landscapes. And so we can talk about beautiful gardens and beautiful plants and beautiful arrangements, but we also want that garden to be something more. Maybe it's a bioretention area, or it's a rain garden, or it is, in this case, a pollinator garden as well, as being a beautiful area. And what we try to do in our programs, and most extension programs across the country do a wonderful job of this, is simply to create awareness of what the problem or the issue might be, and then help educate folks about how they can be inspired and empowered to sort of tackle some of those issues. And I always like to tell folks when I give my talks to master gardeners or to beekeepers that if we build it, they will come. And in this case, I'm not talking about a baseball diamond. I'm talking about pollinator habitat. So we undertook a planting of a really beautiful garden at our J.C. Ralston Arboretum in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I borrowed this slide from my co-author, Ann Spafford. And essentially, we had talked about there are more efficient ways to plant plants in gardens that will help pollinators be more efficient about gathering pollen and nectar. And while this is not was never intended to be a peer-reviewed research study, we would like to expand it eventually so that it becomes that. We decided that we would take the general premise of sort of a research topic and apply it to our garden. And so we have both mass plantings in our beds as well as meadow-like plantings. And so I like to call it random plantings, but I'm not a designer. Anne is, so she sort of helps me decide how to talk about these things. So the idea is essentially if you mass plant or clump them, then because bees prefer to forage on individual species each trip, then they're able to forage on, in this case, let's say echinacea, in a single trip, and they can flip from plant to plant to plant to plant to plant if they're all massed together. However, it takes more energy for them, and it's actually not as good for the plants in terms of pollination strategy if the plants are sort of scattered randomly across a large area. But there's not been very much research done about this, if any, and at this point it's just still speculation. But we used it as a great chance to put in this pollinator garden and sort of begin to sort of tackle the question, are mass plantings better than meadow plantings in terms of pollinator efficiency? It's also a great learning tool. In this case, we included students in all parts of the project, both from helping to write the small grant that we received to, you can see, contracted labor to help plant and to complete the rest of the study as well. And so I'm just talking primarily about our outreach efforts with the rest of my talk. And one of the things we have been really pleased is that the garden has done so well, we've been able to do workshops and field days and, of course, tours. But also, our graduate student Marisol has done an amazing job helping us develop this citizen science activity. And essentially, what we do is we give volunteers, and we've had anywhere from 8 to 18 folks at these volunteer events on Saturday mornings, where they come out and they sort of take a pre-learning activity, you know, survey, and then Marisol gives them a sort of a demonstration presentation to sort of talk to them about the difference between bees and wasps and beetles and butterflies. And it seems on the surface, or at least I was naive enough to think that, well, you know, surely people can tell the difference between a butterfly and a bee. And most people can. That's the exciting part. However, I was surprised to find that most people cannot tell the difference between, say, a bee and many species of flies, or, much to my horror, bees and yellow jackets or wasps. And so the idea is not to make sure that they can identify every single bee down to species, but the idea is that they start to look at characteristics of the insects, and so they're able to identify, okay, this is a bee, this is a good pollinator, and this is a wasp, and maybe I'd like to stay away from that one. So they do a pre and post survey activity, and with the exception, I think, of one gentleman who insisted on not learning the difference between bees and wasps and beetles, everybody learned, felt more confident in IDing the different species of insects. And this is just an example of one of the activity sheets. We ask each of our participants to view a specific plant species and for 10 minutes and simply tally what they see. And then they do a post-activity survey, talk about how they were excited about doing the project beforehand and after and how much they felt they learned, and were they going to go home and plant pollinator habitat. And almost every single person said, yes, they were inspired, yes, it was a great job, and yes, I'm going to go plant pollinator habitat. So the language that we tend to use in extension, right, what did the participants get out of it besides an awesome experience of being able to learn the difference between bees and beetles or bees and wasps? But they really truly gained an understanding and appreciation for not only the design process of how they might design a pollinator space that they'd never considered before, but knowledge about pollinators, the importance of creating and conserving their habitat, but also a sense of ownership. Everybody on their post-survey, before they left for the day, said, yes, I plan to plant pollinator habitat when I plant, you know, something in my garden, or I will go home and plant plants that are pollinator-friendly. And then, of course, we also talk about how to care for their landscape in a way that is not going to harm pollinators. So we talk about spraying and pest management strategies that will protect pollinators. So to wrap up, essentially, the idea is that when people come through our program and we do our outreach activities and we work with these folks, they usually come into the garden sort of with these different ideas, right? And so instead of having these specific ideas every time they see our pollinator garden or another garden, we would like them to think about it this way. So, thanks. And now we're done, right? So everyone should go outside and plant some flowers. Thanks very much. So, I know, everybody's like, I just want to go get a drink. Thank you all very, very much.